Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Instagram propose des outils pour la famille qui permettent à vos proches de naviguer de façon raisonnable et en toute sécurité sur l'application. Quand les ados créent leur profil Instagram, les comptes privés par défaut garantissent que ce qu'ils publient n'est visible que par eux et les personnes qui les suivent. Choisir une limite quotidienne de temps aide votre ado à naviguer de façon raisonnable sur Instagram. Et paramétrer les outils de supervision ensemble vous offre une meilleure visibilité des comptes suivis par votre ado. Pour en savoir plus sur ces outils et en découvrir d'autres, rendez-vous sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 12th of June, these are our main stories. Ukraine says its counteroffensive against Russian troops is making progress, with several villages in the southeast now liberated. The former First Minister of Scotland is arrested and then released during an investigation into the finances of the Scottish National Party. And
this year, in 2023, we've had more civilians killed in Haiti than in Ukraine. Businesses, schools, hospitals are closing or going bankrupt.
Fresh calls for intervention in Haiti amid fears the country is heading for civil war. Also in this podcast, he wins the French Open, but is Novak Djokovic the greatest of all time? And was this the sound hunters were using whistles to make 12,000 years ago? Let's start in Ukraine, though, where we've seen the initial results of the much-talked-of counter-offensive, with Ukrainian troops saying they've taken back control of three villages from the Russians in the southeast. Yuri Sak, who advises Ukraine's defence minister, spoke to BBC News after the recapture of one of them, Blahodatne.
We are fighting inch by inch. For us, every small village is part of Ukraine. In every small village, Ukrainians live, right? So we want to give them back their normal life. So the fact that today a Ukrainian flag is flying over the village of Blahodatnaya, the name Blahodatnaya, if you translate it, it means like a thanksgiving or favorable. So it's a good sign that, you know, one of the first villages to be liberated is this particular one.
Our correspondent in Kyiv, Myeni Jones, told me more about the area that's been retaken.
Quite a small village, only 137 people are reported to be living there. But I think the fact that it's the first territory that the Ukrainian army have claimed that they've conquered since President Zelensky confirmed that the counteroffensive had started yesterday, it's kind of a bit of a morale booster for the troops and for Ukrainians watching the conflict closely. It's in the Donetsk region, not far from Bakhmut, so I think it's also symbolic from that point of view. That was one of the most kind of contested areas. But by and large, Ukrainian forces are keeping quite tight-lipped about their progress and their tactics.
Do you think we're expecting more gains now?
Certainly, that's what President Zelensky will be hoping, that this is the beginning of more gains, regaining crucial territory in the east, in the south, that they lost to Russian forces. I think it's worth noting, though, that this village of Baudatne isn't necessarily the first village that's been recaptured from the Russians. We're now getting reports that a village called Nekushne in Donetsk that has about 530 people living there was liberated yesterday by volunteers. So I think what this tells us is that, you know, this is going to be potentially a long slog, you know, the battle being won small settlement by small settlement.
And are the Russians still trying to make advances of their own?
Verifying things on the Russian side is actually even harder than verifying things on the Ukrainian side. Not much information coming through, but the Russian President Vladimir Putin did say on Friday, after he said that this counteroffensive has started, he did say that it failed to breach Russian defensive lines, that they were losing casualties. And twice this week, the Russian authorities have claimed that they've repelled Ukrainian attacks close to a settlement called Velika Novosilka. So the Russians are claiming that the Ukrainian counteroffensive may have started, but they haven't actually done that well.
Funny as the weekends, Myeni, we've spoken a lot in the past few days on the BBC World Service about the Kakhovka Dam and what happened there. Just bring me up to speed with the latest from that area.
Yes, a rescue operation is still underway. At the moment, Ukrainian authorities are saying that the total area of flooded settlements in Kherson has halved and that the water is going down further. But life hasn't returned to normal for a lot of people. 46 settlements remain flooded. Locals have been told not to use the water in the local area because it's heavily polluted. There's also reports of floating mines. Locals are volunteering to clean up, but we're getting reports that debris has washed up along the Dnipro River and is turning the coastline of the Black Sea into a garbage dump. Apparently, there's lots of bodies of animals and other rubbish from the flood that's been washed up on the coastline there. So still a desperate situation for people in the region.
Miley Jones with me from Kyiv. Scotland's former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon says she's innocent of any wrongdoing after being released without charge following her arrest in connection with an investigation into her party's finances. Detectives are trying to work out what happened to $754,000 worth of donations given to the Scottish National Party for independence campaigning. Ms Sturgeon's husband and the party's former treasurer were arrested in April and released without charge as part of the same investigation. This from our Scotland correspondent, Lorna Gordon.
A dramatic day in Scotland in the developments in this ongoing investigation into the funding and finances of the SNP. Nicola Sturgeon was arrested this morning at 10:09. She was taken into custody and questioned by detectives. This was under arrangement, so it was pre-arranged, this interview and arrest. But she was in custody for 7 hours and 15 minutes, released from custody at 24 minutes past 5 o'clock this afternoon. She hasn't been charged pending further investigation. And for someone who is an accomplished communicator, I think it's fair to say that the emotions came across as quite raw in that statement. She said, "To find myself in the situation I did today, when I am certain I have committed no offence, is both a shock and deeply distressing. Innocence is not just a presumption I am entitled to in law. I know beyond doubt that I am in fact innocent of any wrongdoing."
Lorna Gordon in Glasgow. Novak Djokovic has become the most successful men's singles tennis player in history after his win at the French Open. The Serb beat Casper Ruud in straight sets to secure his record-setting 23rd Grand Slam. Our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller was commentating on the match at Roland Garros.
Casper Ruud did start very well, and Novak Djokovic was nervous, understandably, as he chased this 23rd Grand Slam singles title. He found himself 4-1 down in the first set, but as soon as he'd cancelled out Ruud's advantage, you almost felt you knew what was going to happen. Djokovic won that first set on a tiebreak, and it wasn't plain sailing for him after that, but he was able to win in straight sets in 3 hours and 13 minutes. And then as he went to celebrate with his family and his friends and his coaching team and the players' box, one of those handed him a top which had the number 23 on the chest to signal that he is now the most successful male player in Grand Slam tennis history.
We've seen many tennis greats. What is special about Djokovic, who's now surpassed the achievements of all of them?
His longevity, first and foremost, the way he has kept himself fit. He's 36 years of age. He says there have been a few more physical problems over the last few months that he didn't need to have to worry about. In terms of his tennis playing ability, the serve, the return, the defence, everything looks so simple when he's playing as well as he was today, particularly in the latter stages against Casper Ruud. And his mental strength is just phenomenal. And that is why it is so difficult for anybody, and even perhaps Carlos Alcaraz, who was the world number one until Djokovic won the title here, who started cramping badly at the start of the third set of their semi-final. And he admitted that was because of the intensity of the occasion and the fact that he had Djokovic on the other side of the court.
And what does he do now, Russell? Just go on winning more and more Grand Slams?
Yes, probably wins Wimbledon would be the answer to that. It starts in 3 weeks' time. He's already a 7-time champion at Wimbledon. If he wins one more, then he has more Grand Slams than any other player, male or female, in the Open era, which is since 1968. Serena Williams currently has the same number as Djokovic. And I think also in the back of his mind will be the fact that Margaret Court, who won some of her titles before the Open era began, won 24 in total in her career. And I think he would like very much the fact that he has the chance now of retiring, whenever that time comes, and it could be at least a couple of years away, with more Grand Slam players, at least in singles, than any other player who's played the sport at any time in history.
Russell Fuller with me from Paris. Can Haiti's wretched misery get any worse? It was recently hit by an earthquake and heavy flooding. This in a country with no functioning government, no rule of law, where heavily armed gangs control the streets of the capital, killing, raping and kidnapping at will. It's largely a forgotten tragedy with the world preoccupied with Ukraine and Sudan. But life in the Caribbean nation is a living hell, according to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, who visited earlier this year.
I've just listened to victims and people who work in these neighborhoods where gangs control territory and population, and it's a living hell. I've heard about 500,000 children living in these circumstances, not being able to go to school properly, not being able to be comforted by their parents because their parents are afraid of what might happen the next day. I hear that 20,000 people are in catastrophic famine-like conditions in a country where the world does not put the spotlight on.
So desperate have conditions become that some in Haiti are calling for foreign intervention. Among them, Dr. Jean Pape, executive director of Gescio, which provides free healthcare services in Haiti. Dr. Pape has been talking to Julian Marshall.
The political situation has been a disaster for the past decades and got worse after the assassination of President Moïse in July 2021. Is horrible because we have no elected officials. We have a terrible crisis with a negative growth of the economy for the four consecutive years, 47% inflation, 50% devaluation of the local currency that has created a major humanitarian crisis with the price of food that has increased so much. And it has increased further because of the war in Ukraine and also aggravated by a new phenomenon with the blockage by gangs of the two major routes of entry to the capital, south and north, with crops being rotten because they cannot arrive in the capital. And insecurity is supreme in the capital, with gangs controlling 80% of Port-au-Prince and a large part of the country. In 2022, we had 1,500 kidnapping, a lot of them physicians. This year, in 2023, we've had more civilians killed in Haiti than in Ukraine. Businesses, schools, hospitals are closing or going bankrupt. And we have a police of 4,000 people or less to fight gangs for a population of over 11 million.
How does this widespread insecurity affect your ability to live your life, to do your job?
People are afraid that they would be kidnapped or killed on their way to work. Businesses are not importing materials that we need for hospitals, clinics, etc., medication. In addition, you have the best people leaving the country. It's horrible. When people are kidnapped, a lot of them are being decapitalized. It's terrible for them, not only a traumatic psychological and personal physical experience, but also they don't have any money left. In some neighborhoods, we have some of our employees who work to build their house over 30 years and who had to leave overnight without being able to take anything because the gangs invaded their neighborhood.
And you've been quoted as saying that things have got so bad in Haiti now that the only way to sort it out is foreign intervention.
Correct. I never thought I would come to that point, but the reality is that I'm not the only one who asked for it.
This would be a military intervention, would it?
Yes, but actually, I don't think it would need to be a large-scale intervention. What we need really is support on the ground to the national police with better equipment. We don't even have one tank. Better training so they can conduct the operation. Now, this is special warfare that we are not familiar with. This is something new for us. Our police force was not trained in gang warfare. So if they have that kind of support, I think we'll win it.
What happens to your country if there isn't this foreign intervention?
We'll go into a civil war because many gangs don't get along and the population will be caught in between. And the population itself is arming itself to make sure that they have the proper protection. So unless there is some neutral force that comes in to put some law and order, the situation will degenerate. I'm not the only one who thinks that it will go that way.
Dr. Jean Papp with Julian Marshall. For decades, race-conscious policies in the US have helped to address a lack of women and ethnic minorities in the workplace and education. It's arguably one of the most enduring but challenged civil rights policies enacted by President Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. The US Supreme Court, though, is due to rule on two major cases that may end affirmative action policies in education. The University of North Carolina and Harvard are being accused of discrimination, with a group of Asian Americans claiming Harvard has denied them opportunities in favour of black and Hispanic students. This report from our North America correspondent, Nomia Iqbal.
Oh my God, view status update. I got into Harvard!
Getting into an Ivy League university is a big deal. Students spend a long time on their admissions forms and wait nervously.
View update.
Yes, I can!
The last video you heard was of Jerome Fulton. He made it to Harvard Business School.
For me, as a black person from Miami, whose parents were not formally educated, you know, were murdered by the time I was 5 years old, I did not have a lot of opportunity.
Jerome's race would have been one of many factors considered on his form.
I feel like affirmative action had to play a huge role in where I am. There had to be a set of policies and procedures that help create an equitable landscape for me.
Universities aren't allowed to do quotas. Instead, affirmative action policies created in the 60s allow the schools to consider race as a factor. Kate Peltz is an admissions counselor.
There's a perception that admissions is based, you know, strictly on qualifications. And the reality is that it might be academic qualifications, but it also could be extracurricular qualifications. It's also the circumstances of their life.
The idea is affirmative action creates a diverse student body, but for decades, many white students have challenged it, saying it discriminates against them. This time round, it's unique because affirmative action is being challenged by a group of Asian American students. Students for Fair Admissions claim that affirmative action is paradoxically making it worse for other ethnic minorities.
I am a senior in high school.
Rutledge was rejected from all the Ivy League universities he applied for. There's no evidence it was due to being Indian American, but he suspects it.
The worry that when an admission officer sees, you know, a Patel, when he sees a Kim, when he sees any Asian last name, basically the image that comes up is, you know, a kid just sitting in his Kumon class and studying away at math.
The man who heads up the group that has brought this lawsuit against Harvard University is not a lawyer. He's a legal strategist who has brought case after case to the Supreme Court in an attempt to get rid of affirmative action policies. Will Edward Bloom get his way this summer? I came to his home in Florida to meet him.
We believe race should never be an element.
I spoke to a young black man who got into Harvard Business School, and I put to him, you know, could affirmative action policies have helped you get there? And he said to me, so what if it did?
Well, put the shoe on the other foot. Suppose the question you would pose to him was, gee, you know, you were rejected from Harvard Business School, and the reason you were rejected is because you're black. Would you think that is fair?
Harvard University disputes the case, saying the percentage of Asian Americans admitted has grown by 27% since 2010. They and the University of North Carolina says the student group has irresponsibly misrepresented the truth.
Education rights are under attack. What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
It's an emotional and divisive subject. Many students have been protesting ahead of the ruling. Critics say affirmative action undermines meritocracy, while supporters say it actually strengthens it. The Supreme Court will decide this summer.
Nomia Iqbal reporting. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
There's a track that I ended up calling From the Mountains. That track in particular somehow defines to me what the record is about. It's got that mood.
One of the world's great jazz guitarists, Pat Metheny, on his latest album. The United States and Saudi Arabia have strongly condemned the resumption of violence between the two warring factions in Sudan. Residents in Khartoum say there have again been exchanges of gun and shell fire after the expiry of a 24-hour truce on Sunday. The ceasefire had held better than previous ones. The lull in the fighting between the army and the rival paramilitary force, the RSF, had allowed people to try to stock up on essentials. Some people were caught off guard, though, when the violence erupted again. Mohamed Hashim has been monitoring developments in Sudan.
I was speaking to someone. He said he wanted to go into downtown Khartoum to see if he can get some food for his kids to return back to his house in South Khartoum. He said when he left the home, it was 5 a.m, it was quiet. Within an hour, he was caught in the fighting and he couldn't even make his destination into downtown Khartoum and he had to run. We're seeing various reports of very heavy fighting across the three cities that make the Sudanese capital. But the reality is food, water, electricity are in very short supply. You speak to people who haven't had water for weeks. You speak to people who haven't had any food or struggling to buy supplies. The situation in Darfur appears to be very grim. We don't have any reports from the ground. We don't have any independent journalists in Darfur. People are speaking about an ethnic cleansing campaign, in effect, happening in and around Jenina, which is the capital of West Darfur. It has been very violent there. Many people have fled the city in their hundreds of thousands, crossed over into Chad. The doctors' union in Jenina issued a statement today saying that they don't have any more health facilities remaining in the state, and the number of the casualties is just too high for them to give an accurate tally.
Mahan and Hashim reporting. 6 police officers go on trial on charges of manslaughter today in Switzerland after the arrest and subsequent death of a Nigerian man, Mike Ben Peter, in the city of Lausanne 5 years ago. The dead man's family and anti-racist groups in Switzerland have drawn parallels with the death of George Floyd, killed by the police in the US city of Minneapolis. From Bern, here's Imogen Folks.
The prosecution claims Swiss police used such violence against 40-year-old Mike Ben Peter from Nigeria that he stopped breathing, suffered a heart attack, and then died 12 hours later in hospital. He was stopped late one evening in Lausanne by a policeman who suspected him of drug dealing. When he refused to be searched, 6 officers pinned him to the ground, some reportedly kneeling on his back for several minutes, during which he lost consciousness. The defence argues the police acted responsibly and claim Mike Ben Peter's death was likely due to underlying heart problems and the fact he was overweight. The case is coming to trial just a few months after a UN report said Switzerland had a problem with systemic racism. The Swiss authorities accepted that racism needed to be tackled with greater urgency, but questioned whether the UN's use of a few specific cases really proved that racism was systemic.
The European Union is ready to offer more than €1 billion in financial aid to Tunisia amid Europe's ongoing migration crisis. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen, alongside leaders from Italy and the Netherlands, met the Tunisian President Kais Saied. He wants to establish an agreement on better border control and tighter measures on people smuggling across the Mediterranean. Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhard told me more about what the leaders were proposing.
Well, some of it was financial aid. Tunisia's economy is struggling currently. I mean, they were talking about more than $1 billion of aid. But obviously, this is a proposal and it will need the other elements of the deal to come together. So what's happening is that Ursula von der Leyen, Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, and the Netherlands Prime Minister Mark Rutte were talking with Kais Saied. They're trying to get a comprehensive partnership package, a memorandum of understanding on that, and then an agreement by the end of June. They're also looking to boost investment, things like digital economy. There's an undersea cable that will bring high-speed broadband to Tunisia. They want to get a renewable energy and a cable that will go to Italy for that. But most particular, migration, which is one of the most sensitive political issues in the European Union. They want to tackle people smuggling and the cynical business model that involves, they said, and also to strengthen Tunisia's border management. They're proposing giving €100 million this year for that, as well as improved search and rescue missions to help with the return of migrants and the registration of them.
3 significant European leaders in Tunisia. Do you get the sense that there's the political will across the continent to try and do something about the migration situation?
Yeah, well, it was particularly interesting that Ursula von der Leyen should be accompanying Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni on this. Now, Giorgia Meloni has made it one of her right-wing government in Italy's chief priorities to bring down irregular migration, to tackle this at source. And this shows a sort of a coalescing between Brussels, which Italy's right wing has traditionally had an antagonistic relationship with, and Meloni on a practical level. And also, obviously, earlier this week, we saw an agreement on a fairer distribution system of migrants across the EU and speedier processing of migrants and also deportation of ones who are deemed not to be legitimate asylum seekers. So there does seem to be a movement in that direction. there are sort of objections in some parts of Europe, Poland and Hungary.
Some people are worried at the moment about democracy being eroded in Tunisia. Anyone say anything about that today as part of all this?
The European Union representatives today talked about a troubled road for democracy in Tunisia, but they certainly didn't make a big play of this. It seems that other issues are more important. Now, Kais Saied has been criticised basically for stripping the Tunisian parliament of much of its power, of creating a sort of a supercharged presidency, basically, and ruling in a much more authoritarian way, and undermining some of the democratic gains of the Arab Spring. Tunisia, of course, for a long time was the poster child of the Arab Spring.
Danny Eberhard reporting. Archaeologists have unearthed a collection of 12,000-year-old flutes carved out of tiny bird bones at a prehistoric site in Israel. It's believed they could be the earliest evidence of the use of sound in hunting. Here's Rebecca Wood.
The sound of a common kestrel. And that's a sparrowhawk. Two birds of prey that archaeologists believe hunter-gatherers may have tried to imitate when looking for food tens of thousands of years ago. And the evidence they have is the discovery of seven tiny waterfowl wing bones with small holes bored in them, a sort of flute that might have been used to recreate bird calls. The specimens were found in wetlands in the Hule Valley in northern Israel, known to be a settlement site from the Natufian period of hunter-gatherer communities. One of the theories suggested in the Nature Science Report journal is that hunters positioned themselves near the waterfowl and would use the sounds of the flute to scare them, making them take off in all directions and giving the hunters a better chance of catching their lunch. Well, if that is true, experts at the Israel Antiquities Authority say these instruments would be the earliest evidence of the use of sound in hunting. An alternative theory is that the flutes could have been used to make music, but that wouldn't earn them any kind of exciting title, as Slovenia already claims it owns the world's oldest musical instrument, a 60,000-year-old Neanderthal flute discovered in a cave that now resides in the country's National Museum.
Rebecca Wood reporting. Pat Metheny is one of the world's great jazz guitarists, winning 20 Grammys and collaborating with the likes of Herbie Hancock and David Bowie. His career began in the US in the 60s. At the age of 18, he was already teaching music at Miami University. He's been talking to Martin Venard about his latest album, which is called Dreambox.
The word box has several connotations among jazz musicians. Most of all, it means electric hollow body guitar. But also, this particular record is sort of a found record in a way. I'm always writing new music, and I kind of keep a file going of these basically duets of myself playing chords, and then I play the melody to the tune that I just wrote over the chords, and then maybe improvise a little on it, and then usually put it away, never to be heard again. And this whole record is sort of a group of extracted items from this folder of dozens that I found myself returning to over and over again on the last tour that I did. And it all does have kind of a dreamy feel to it. There's a track that I ended up calling From the Mountains. That track in particular somehow defines to me what the record is about. It's got that mood. The second track that we put out was called Ole and Guard, which was, again, something I wrote as a quick demo for two friends of mine who were coming to my house, and I thought, oh, I'll write a little tune for us to play.
And you've released many albums and many tracks over the decades, and one of my favourites is Last Train Home. Where does that rank among your favourites?
It's a pretty special one, I have to say, because it's one of those tunes that gets played at weddings and funerals and births. Just the sound of that song and the nature of the groove that goes with it, I think, is something that people can almost immediately grab onto as having a relationship to trains. In a lot of ways, Midwest America, which is where I grew up, literally with my bedroom about 10 meters from the biggest cross-country railroad freight line in America, the Missouri Pacific. I feel extremely lucky that I've been able to be around not only great musicians, but some musicians like Steve Reich or Herbie Hancock, where you just kind of say their name and there's this kind of sound that emerges, like you know what that means. Sonny Rollins, David Bowie was like that. Like, you got to come up with your own way. And the best music for me is represented in people who have done that. And the challenge is actually, what can I do next that seems to be the best use of my remaining time? Not that I'm planning on checking out anytime soon.
The jazz legend Pat Metheny with Martin Bennard. And that's it from us for now. A new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast, drop us an email, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or on Twitter, we're @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.